Well, good evening. We are continuing our study of the historical reliability of the Bible, in particular focusing the majority of this class on the New Testament and the Gospels in particular. And we have, in our series, have been working through positive and negative external and internal evidence, and we've made it finally to the negative evidence, starting with the external negative evidence. We'll be talking about the alleged historical errors, the things that skeptics say the gospel authors got wrong. And as you might guess from the title screen, you're right, Tom, it doesn't go backwards very well. When we're talking about Matthew and Mark tonight, that means that this is going to take a couple of classes to get through this as well. So we'll come back next week and wrap up the Gospels as we work our way through this. And then we'll come back and talk about alleged contradictions. We'll pick up the specific topic of miracles and how that relates to our discussion, and wrap up our discussion of the Gospels, in particular with the resurrection. So that's kind of where we're headed and where we've been as well. And so tonight, as we talk about the allegations of historical error made by skeptics, really we're going to do three basic things. We're going to, first of all, just try to understand the challenges that are posed by the claim of historical error. Then we'll talk about some of the specific historical objections that are made in these Gospels, and of course assess the case for the genuineness of the documents in light of that. Can we, you know, show that these aren't historical errors? And this is not stuff that that we'll be talking about that has been known to be, you know, false for hundreds of years. Well, some of it has been, but skeptics still make the claim. What I'm saying is, we're not talking about things like, you know, 50 years ago they thought this was a historical error, then they found some great archaeological discovery that proved it wrong, and I'm going to rehash that to show the Gospels are accurate. What we're going to be talking about are things that, if you read a modern, recently published critical, skeptical commentary on the Bible, these are the kinds of allegations you will still read today, most of these. The better critical scholars will at least interact with the answers that we'll talk about, even if they ultimately reject them. Now, just kind of by way of disclaimer, what we're not doing tonight is proving the doctrine of inspiration. We're kind of looking at this with the doctrine of inspiration kind of on the side. We believe that. We accept that. That gives us great confidence in the documents. But as you talk to a skeptic and the kinds of things they might raise as an objection, it's hard to, well, it's easy to say they're inspired, but that's not going to carry much weight with them. And so what we'll do tonight won't by any stretch prove inspiration to be true. And I don't think it will even definitively, conclusively answer everything that someone might ever raise. I don't claim to have all of the answers to all of the questions that anybody could ever raise. And in some of the difficult passages, you will find good believing scholars that disagree with each other, and they'll come to different conclusions as to how to rectify difficulties. And so there are some questions that, you know, what we can do is offer suggestions and say, you know, there are plausible explanations, and we don't know exactly what the answer is, but it's not a certain historical error, or as we continue on, not a certain contradiction, because there are a variety of plausible and probable even explanations to those kinds of issues. So our goal tonight is to show the genuine trustworthiness, the general trustworthiness, the general genuineness of the gospel record. Now, to talk about the big picture argument itself, what it all really boils down to, this is what the skeptic will say. I don't know if he would say it quite like this, but this is basically what it boils down to. First, if the Gospels are trustworthy documents, they would not contain numerous historical errors. Second, the Gospels contain numerous historical errors. Therefore, the Gospels are not trustworthy. That's the basic argument. I think we would all agree with the first premise. If the Gospels are genuine, and we might say if they are inspired by God, they would not be filled with all kinds of historical errors. God would not create a document like that. If we are believing in the person of Jesus being a historical figure that we are following because he actually lived and did these things, they're not going to be filled with historical errors. So I think we all agree very well with the first premise. And I think we could agree with the third premise as far as it goes, which is to say that if the second premise is true, then the third premise is true as well. That's basic logic. It follows that if the second premise is true, the third one is as well. And so the critical issue to examine in this skeptical position is this second premise. Is it true that the Gospels contain numerous historical errors? Now, as you look at this kind of argument, and you bring it to the Gospel of Mark in particular, then the argument kind of expands even more than that. Because the basic premise of a lot of, probably most, New Testament scholars is that Mark was the first Gospel written, and Matthew and Luke were both acquainted with Mark. And I won't say that they just copied Mark. I don't know too many people that would say it quite like that, but they were aware of Mark. They used Mark in some degree or another. And what we'll do this evening is we'll grant that. I don't think it's quite as simple as all of that, but for the sake of argument, let's take that position. Let's say it is true that Mark was written first. It is true the other Gospels were aware of it and used Mark in their writing. So we'll just, for the sake of argument, say that's the case. And then what the skeptic would say is, well, Mark contains errors in Palestinian geography and Jewish culture and Jewish law. Therefore, Mark was not written by someone that had firsthand knowledge of that situation. It was not written by an actual eyewitness or information supplied by an actual eyewitness. And then, if the author of Matthew was the Apostle Matthew, he wouldn't have used the defective book that Mark would have been. Therefore, they would conclude, Matthew wasn't written by the Apostle Matthew. And if Matthew isn't written by the Apostle Matthew, then there's no good reason to trust that either. Therefore, on the basis of Mark being filled with historical errors and Matthew using Mark, Matthew and Mark are both out, is kind of the way that goes. Now, there's some convoluted stuff going on there. But I think you could say that the logic at least follows to some degree that if Mark is filled with historical errors, Matthew probably wouldn't use that if it was the apostle. And you can kind of see how they could come to that conclusion, even if you wouldn't necessarily agree with everything that's part of that logical chain there. And so again, what we're going to be doing is starting with Mark, investigating some of these alleged historical errors and seeing if they actually hold up. Then we'll come back and pick up Matthew at the end of class, time permitting. Charlie? Right, and I don't know. I mean, I've not read too many skeptics that outline the point exactly this way to say, you know, where their cutoff would be. They are dealing with the Gospels. The skeptical position of skeptical scholars who study the Gospels do not believe it to be inspired. I mean, what we might say is if there's one, that's too many for an inspired document. But since they're not coming to it with the perspective that it's inspired, they would allow a few mistakes and it still be generally trustworthy. I don't know where their cutoff would be. That's an interesting question. You'd have to ask somebody, one of their scholars, and see what they'd say. But then again, it was just kind of like one big thing that swung Bart Ehrman from super fundamentalist to super liberal. So maybe it would just take one for some of them at least. So, all right, well, let's talk about some of the alleged errors in Mark, starting with Mark chapter 5. It would help if I'd go to Mark 5 instead of Matthew 5. Mark chapter 5, and we're not going to take the time to read all of the text of all of these passages. We just don't have the time to do this evening. But this is the story of the demoniac in the country of the Gerasenes, is the way my translation is rendering it in Mark chapter 5 and verse 1. This is the story where Jesus cast the demons out, and they are cast into the herd of swine, and the swine run down the hillside, and they fall into the Sea of Galilee, and they drown. And the reason that this is a problem, here's a map of the region, and I know you can't see this. You can see the Sea of Galilee up here at the top, of course. What you might not be able to see, anyone who can, tell me. This says Gerasa right here. Anyone could see this? I don't know why I said might. So Gerasa is way down there, far southeast of the Sea of Galilee. So if Jesus is down there in Gerasa, the country of the Gerasenes, and he casts the demons out into this herd of swine, they would then have to run 37 miles And of course, they fall into the Sea of Galilee because they are just completely exhausted at that point. Maybe they were given some kind of super strength by the demons to make it that far that fast. I'm not sure how anyone would have seen that happen unless they were running along following them. But you can see what the basic problem is here. And on top of that, this verse begins, Mark chapter 5 and verse 1, begins, they came to the other side of the sea, to the country of the Gerasenes. Well, the other side of the sea from where? Well, if you go back up, what you find is the previous chapter that was set in Capernaum, which is northwest corner of the Sea of Galilee. And so you think the other side of the sea they come to is going to be somewhere on the east coast of the Sea of Galilee, not way down there in the middle of the Decapolis Transjordan kind of region. And so this is the first of the allegations we'll mention. And unfortunately, I'm gonna begin by putting it on hold because we're going to come back to this one because this is also going to be an issue in Matthew. And we'll offer the solutions to both at the same time. But I want you to have this at least in the back of your mind. So the error, the alleged error, is that Mark doesn't know the geography of Palestine very well. He thinks that Gerasa is somewhere near the Sea of Galilee when it is obviously way down a very long way away. So Mark doesn't know what he's talking about. Is the basic premise. Now, we'll come back to this, we'll address this, but we're going to put that one on hold because we're going to talk about that in the context of Matthew. So, moving on then to Mark chapter 7, we'll talk briefly about this one because we've talked about it in a previous class already. But I do want to bring it to mind, particularly because I know that at least some people will vary from week to week, and you may have not been one of the ones who have been here for that. Mark chapter 7 and verse 31, speaking of Jesus, he's been up in the region of Tyre and Sidon. It says, he returned from the region of Tyre and went through Sidon to the Sea of Galilee in the region of the Decapolis. And they brought him a man who was deaf and had a speech impediment, and the story goes on from there. Well, what's the problem with this? Well, in the words of one particular scholar who's written a commentary on Mark, he says the evangelist, speaking of Mark, was not directly acquainted with Palestine. Well, what would make someone say Mark isn't aware of what's going on in the land of Palestine because of this verse that he went from Tyre to Galilee via Sidon? Well, it's because if you look at this high-quality map here, you see Tyre is here, if you can see the laser where it's pointing. Sea of Galilee is down here. So if you're going to go from here to here, you're probably going to go like this, not like way north and then back down. And so the allegation is Mark doesn't know what he's talking about because no one would go that way. Unfortunately, this is a great example of modern scholars presuming that they know more than anybody else because they looked at a map like this one. As we talked about when we talked about this before, there is something that stands between Tyre and the Sea of Galilee, and it is a 3,700-foot mountain. Mount Meron is actually in between, and you can get an idea of that from this more topographical kind of map. So here's Tyre here. Sidon is up north. Galilee's down here, you see the huge mountain range. Yet if you go north to Sidon and you come back down, you're going to find a nice little pass in the mountains where there is the Jordan Valley, in fact, that runs right through there. So not only do you have an easier trek, but you have fresh water at hand all the way along there. And so this is an illustration where Mark is not the one who is ignorant of the geography. It is the skeptic who alleges that Mark is ignorant of the geography who is, in fact, ignorant of the geography. Nobody except, you know, people that enjoy hiking. Robert would enjoy it if he was here. I'm sure he'd raise his hand. But, I mean, you're going from Tyre, which is basically, by definition, at sea level, up 3,700 feet, up Mount Meron, which is directly between Tyre and the Sea of Galilee, and then down well below sea level to Galilee. The Sea of Galilee is the lowest freshwater lake in the world. It's 700 feet below sea level. And so it would be a significant trek in both directions. And if you've done any mountain climbing, you know that very often going down is harder than coming up the mountain for a variety of reasons. And so this is a great illustration of the author, in fact, knowing far more about the land than the skeptics. That's probably because they actually lived in the land, unlike the skeptics who were, you know, writing, looking for holes to poke in things. All right, moving on then. Mark chapter 10 and verse 1. Speaking of Jesus, he left there and went to the region of Judea and beyond the Jordan, and the crowds gathered to him again. And again, as was his custom, he taught them. Well, the allegation here is, I would say, ridiculous. But basically what it says is that Jesus, who is on the west side of the Jordan in this context, crosses the Jordan into Judea. So it's another example, they say, of Mark not knowing the geography. One commentator said that this is an example of theological geography. I've not tracked down the full quote to figure out what on earth that meant, but it was part of the allegation that Mark didn't know the actual geography. The problem with that is that it's very obvious, if you just read it carefully, that Mark is not saying that he crossed the Jordan into Judea. It's saying that he was, again, initially in Galilee, and he left Galilee and went to Judea, and when he was in Judea, he crossed the Jordan and went beyond the Jordan. It's very pretty straightforward as to what is being said here. And this, I think, is really just an example of skeptics inventing problems with the Bible because they're looking for problems. It's the kind of thing that if you're looking hard enough for something, you're going to find it no matter what it is that you're looking for. And if you are a skeptic that doesn't believe that Mark actually wrote back in the first century, that Mark was someone who wrote later on, that didn't actually know the geography, every little thing you see, you're going to, you know, make a mountain out of that molehill and find problems where there aren't problems. And I think this is a great example of that. It uses the phrase region of Judea and beyond the Jordan, and that is misconstrued to mean they cross the Jordan into Judea from, you know, from the west to the east, when the Jordan was kind of the eastern boundary of Judea. And so this, I really think, is just an example of an invented problem due to the poor reading of the text. Not a real problem, but this is published. I mean, it's the, for those of you who are familiar with commentary sets, it's the Anchor Bible commentary that alleges that this is theological geography going on here. Charlie?
Well, even if they say, you know, Jesus crossed the Jordan into the Judean region, wasn't it most practiced by Jews to avoid Samaria, to Galilee,
and Judea? Yeah, and if That could be a possibility. Again, I don't think that's what's being said here specifically, but you know, they did go Transjordan route very often to avoid Samaria, so they'd cross the Jordan, go south, cross the Jordan back into Judea. And so, yeah, I don't know why that wouldn't be the natural reading if it did actually say that. Again, I just think this is an example of skeptics inventing problems more than anything. All right, Mark chapter 11 and verse 1. Yeah, go ahead. I don't know. Well, the people that are writing these commentaries, they're reading in the original language, so I don't know what they're picking up, why they're not able to piece it together, beyond the fact that I think a lot of times they're looking for problems. You want to say anything about this one, Tom?
Well, there is a textual variation of the manuscripts of Mark. Some put in hand in there, some regions of Judea and beyond the Jordan, and others leave the and out, so it'd be the hill country of Judea beyond the Jordan. And that's the way Matthew puts it in Matthew 19. So,
okay.
But yeah, I think like Charlie said, they're assuming which way you're crossing.
Yeah.
Any number of reasons why you might cross one direction or the other.
So. Right. And so that, I mean, this is another one where you might wind up saying there are a variety of solutions to this problem. It's not an issue where here is a clear historical error that Mark has made and there's no way out of this, there's no possible other understanding of this. And that's the other problem that the skeptics bring very often to the issue of you know, historical reliability of the Bible, is they presume that their skeptical way of reading it is the only way of reading it, and that any other option is, you know, either not there at all or a cop-out of some kind, whereas you can offer 3, 4, 5 plausible explanations to what's going on and just all of them be completely ignored. So even if we don't know for sure what the answer is, it seems pretty clear that there is a possible answer out there somewhere. All right, Mark 11, verse 1. Here Jesus is heading to Jerusalem at this point. He is coming from Jericho. We saw him in Jericho up at the end of Mark chapter 10 where he heals Bartimaeus. Mark chapter 11, when they drew near to Jerusalem, to Bethphage and Bethany at the Mount of Olives, Jesus sent two of his disciples. You remember Jesus sends his disciples ahead to arrange getting the colt for what's going to be the triumphal entry later on. The reason that this is an issue is because it's the wrong direction. So we'll zoom in on our map a little bit here, and you still can't see a thing, of course. But here is Jericho, and here is Jerusalem, and Bethany is here, and Bethphage is there. So Bethany is just a touch east of Bethphage. And so what the skeptic says is if you are traveling from Jerusalem, or from Jericho to Jerusalem, Bethany will come before Bethphage, and here in Mark 11, it says to Bethphage and Bethany. So he gets them in the wrong order. Therefore, Mark doesn't know the geography. And again, I am not making this stuff up. They actually say this thing. Here's the quote. Mark did not know the relative positions of these two villages. To which I would say Mark doesn't say that they first came to Bethphage. He says they came to this area. And I think that's what's important is if you carefully read this text and you say, what is Mark saying? What he is saying is when they got to this general region, the region of Bethphage and Bethany. And the reason why these two cities are listed this way as the area of these two towns is because these two towns are a whopping 800 yards apart from each other. I mean, really, that's all they are. They're about, you know, half a mile or something separating the two of them. They're very small villages on the eastern slope of the Mount of Olives, about 800 yards apart. And what Mark is saying is not which one they got to first in relation to each other, but when they were in this general vicinity, this is when Jesus sent these disciples ahead to arrange getting this colt. And I mean, this is another example of, I think, just saying, you know, common sense. I mean, really, are you looking that hard for errors that you're going to point this out as a real historical error, a real problem, when a common sense reading of what's going on here provides a much better answer to that? All right, I'll stop for a second. Any other? Yeah, Tom.
Oh, we have the same thing. If you're driving from West Texas, you say, I passed through Dallas-Fort Worth, even though you come to Fort Worth first, mm-hmm. We say Tampa, St. Pete. We always put it in that order. We don't say St. Pete, Tampa.
Right.
And you just have those kind of common types of ways to phrase it.
Right. And I've not looked up, that'd be a good thing to look up, is if you can find references to these two towns outside the Bible and see if they always show up in that order. That would really put a nail in the coffin of this argument. But again, I think it's skeptics looking for things is what it amounts to. Mark 7, this is one I thought about talking about a few weeks ago, but decided not to, if I remember correctly. Mark chapter 7 and verse 3, this is the hand-washing issue where the Pharisees are taking issue with the disciples and Jesus is going to go on really just lay into the Pharisees pretty well here. But he's going to say, you know, what defiles someone is not what goes into him, but what comes out of him. But the Pharisees are upset. They see that his disciples are eating with hands that were defiled, that is, unwashed. Verse 3, for the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they wash their hands, holding to the tradition of the elders. And, you know, this is kind of common sense for people in our day and age. Well, of course you wash your hands before you eat. But what people allege here is that this was not the custom of all the Jews. Our good friend Bart Ehrman, who we've talked about, this is what he says. He says, Mark 7:3 indicates the Pharisees and all the Jews washed their hands before eating so as to observe the tradition of the elders. This is not true. Most Jews did not engage in this ritual. Of course, he's been around the first century a lot to watch what the Jews actually did, and he knows very well firsthand, clean hand, I'm sure, what they were doing. Well, where does this kind of conclusion come from? Well, part of the the allegation comes from the Old Testament itself, because there are rules about hand washing in the Old Testament, in Exodus 30, in Exodus 40, in Leviticus 20. And what you find are the regulations and the rules about hand washing and cleanliness are for the priests, not the general populace. And from that, it is extrapolated out, and from some other things as well, but from that it's extrapolated out that they did not wash their hands. It was only something for the priests to do. But the question really isn't, what does the law say? The question is, what do the tradition of the elders say? Because that's what they're citing, not the law, but the traditions of their forefathers. And so what was actually going on in Jesus' day? And what you find is that before Jesus' day, during Jesus' day, and after Jesus' day, there is reference outside of the Bible to the general populace engaging in the ritual washing of their hands. So you go back a couple hundred years before the time of Jesus and the letter of Aristeus, and it says, "And as is the custom of all the Jews, they washed their hands in the sea and prayed to God." If you look at what Philo says in A.D. 30, precise contemporary with Jesus, "No cleanliness of those who touched a dead body." This is what he's talking about, that you cannot have cleanliness if you've touched a dead body, quote, "until they have washed and purified themselves with sprinklings and ablutions." And then after the time of Christ, in the Mishnah, it refers to hand washing of all the people as well, which the Mishnah, if anything, would contain the traditions of the elders. It's the rabbinic writings in that document. And then on top of all of these inscriptional kinds of evidence, there's also archaeological evidence, and part of that are these mikvah, these baptismal pools, and other kinds of washing areas that were basically all over the land. They had them at Masada, in the fortress where they, held out as long as they could against the Romans. I mean, why on earth would you have mikvah for washing at Masada if it's only something for the priests and nobody else did it? Why would you have them scattered out all around the countryside? Why would they have them in Qumran? They're all over the place. And again, what that points to is the fact that this was certainly the case. So this is an accusation that's made of Mark being a bad historian, when in reality, this is a case of Bart Ehrman being a bad historian. I mean, there is example upon example upon example arguing exactly the opposite of what Ehrman says, which is they did all, in fact, wash their hands. And so Mark would be right in what the Pharisees said. Any questions, comments here? Yeah.
What was that person's name
mentioned? The letter of Aristeus. Anything else? All right, Mark chapter 10 and verse 12, as I get a whole ahead of myself. Mark chapter 10, this is something that you don't find in all the gospel accounts of Jesus teaching about divorce. Mark chapter 10, verse 11, for the full context, "Whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery against her. And if she divorces her husband and marries another, she commits adultery." Well, this allegation is that Mark doesn't really know his culture very well, or the culture that he's writing about very well, because the law has no provision whatsoever for women divorcing men. If you go back and you look through the law, all it ever talks about is men divorcing women. And if you look at what the Pharisees seem to be teaching, they only talk about men divorcing women. The idea of a woman divorcing a man was completely off the radar. So why would Mark do this? And the two things that people suggest, and I didn't track down quotes on all of this, but one accusation is Mark is just ignorant of the time. Of course, you'd expect a skeptic to say something like that. The other is that Mark changed Jesus' teaching, or modified the teaching a little bit, for his Roman audience. It's widely believed that Mark wrote to a Roman group of people, and that seems to be a good conclusion. We won't chase that, why that is, out, but that seems to be a reasonable conclusion, that Mark wrote to a Roman audience. And in Rome, this was a legal issue. Donahue and Harrington, in their commentary, say this is generally regarded as an addition to Jesus' teaching that was made to address situations related to Roman legal practices whereby a woman could initiate divorce proceedings. And so what Mark is doing is he's taking the basic principle of what Jesus says and, kind of like preachers do every now and then, modify it a little bit to suit the contemporary situation. And I don't know if Mark is putting words in Jesus' mouth, or the translators who put certain words in red are the ones that put words in Jesus' mouth, but that's the basic idea, is Jesus didn't actually say this part, and Mark just really doesn't know what he's doing, or he's changing things a little bit. The problem with that is there is an outstanding example of a woman divorcing a man in first century Palestinian culture, in fact, in Galilee, where Jesus was doing his teaching, that is very contemporary to Jesus' situation, that everybody would have known about and would have been the exact kind of thing that Jesus could have had in mind as he did this. In fact, Jesus' forerunner happened to have been executed as a result of this very divorce. And the way Josephus talks about it, when Herodias divorced Philip so that she could marry Antipas, Josephus says that Herodias, quote, took it upon herself to confound the laws of our country. And in doing that, she divorced Philip so that she could be with Antipas instead. I mean, it is hard for Jesus to get more culturally applicable than what he says here in Mark chapter 10. I mean, this is right on the pulse of the nation. And for Mark to quote this, yeah, it might sound like something that is way out in left field in the Jewish culture, but in reality, if you understand what is actually going on in first century Galilee at that very moment, for him to include this detail, I mean, that really, it shows a lot of accuracy. It shows a lot of knowledge of what's going on. It's exactly the opposite of what the skeptics would say. The skeptics would say, Mark doesn't know what he's talking about because this wouldn't even be on their radar. Oh, but it would be on their radar, and in spite of the fact that it might look like it's off the wall, Mark included it anyway, showing that he was being incredibly accurate in what he was recording. All right, moving along, the trial of Jesus, a couple of things that are said about this. First of all, that it can't be an accurate portrayal of the trial because there's so much of it that is against the customs of the day. Trials were forbidden at night, and this trial seemed to be at night. Trials could only be held at the temple, and this was held at the house of the high priest. Trials couldn't be held at Passover, and this was held during Passover. There had to be 24 hours before sentencing in a capital case, and the sentence was pronounced immediately. Therefore, Mark didn't know what he was talking about because he included all of that. Then one other thing that goes along with that is that the charge of blasphemy would be anachronistic, which is to say out of time, because nobody would have equated Jesus' claim to be the Messiah with a claim to be God, because that's just not how the Jews thought of the Messiah in that day. And so this must have been written, you know, 150 years later or whatever, because that's when they were thinking of the Messiah as God. But none of the Jews would have made that connection in that day. In fact, if it wasn't a use of the divine name, it wouldn't be blasphemy at all. That's what E.P. Sanders says about that. So those are kinds of the charges here. Now, I've seen some hands already. Sam, are you going to say something? Oh, no, that should say Mark 14 is what that should say. You know, that's a typo is what that is. Brother Winton.
The Pharisees themselves said that if there was a unanimous vote, it didn't count.
Okay.
It was free, and they ignored this because it was a unanimous vote.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, that's just we could continue to add to the illegalities of this trial. Jonathan, were you going to say something?
I'm just struck by the whole logic of it. Well, if there was something to do things a certain way, they couldn't possibly ignore their own laws.
Well, that's part of the problem, is because according to Josephus, Book 20, Chapter 9, Section 1, there is at least one really good example where they do ignore their own laws, and that has to do with the execution of James, the brother of Jesus. I don't remember what all the details are. I wrote down the citation without really studying it in detail. I kind of glanced through it. But basically, it has something to do with it being an interim period between Roman procurators, if I remember correctly. Is that what it is, Tom? And they don't follow their own rules in relation to that. So, I mean, the logical issue is a sound one. On top of that, we've got great historical evidence that they don't always follow their own rules. And so to say that this Mark must be wrong because they're not following their own rules, I mean, Just go to the courthouse any day of the week and watch people try to get out of following the rules of the land. I mean, that's what the position of defense attorney is, basically. I hope I'm not offending anybody with defense attorneys and their family. But, I mean, it's all the time. So to say that Mark can't be doing it, I think the point is very clear in all of the Gospels, and it's not that we're idiotic authors and we don't know what we're talking about. It's these people are flagrantly ignoring their own laws to get rid of Jesus. And I think that's the larger point. And to say that they must be wrong, they're historically wrong because they wouldn't break their own rules, misses the real point of the narrative. All right, as to this charge of blasphemy being anachronistic, that it would not follow in that day, if you look at Mark 14, hey, my notes say 14 this time, Mark 14, verses 61 through 64, I think this problem goes away as well. But he remained silent and made no answer, speaking of Jesus. Again, the high priest asked him, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed?" Now, his answer is not, "Yes, I'm the Christ." And they said, "Oh, you blasphemed." His answer is, "I am, and you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of the heaven." Now, when have you heard this idea of the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the heaven before? Anyone know where that comes from? Well, it's in Acts as well, the ascension, but it originally is from Daniel 7. And in Daniel 7, Daniel sees a vision, and there is this Son of Man figure who is equated with God himself. In fact, even Bart Ehrman agrees on this point, that Son of Man equals divinity. And Jesus saying, "I am the Son of Man," everyone would have acknowledged that as a claim to be divine. Now, as to the issue of it has to involve the divine name of God to be blasphemy, again, you can go to Philo, and there are a couple of examples of Philo treating the assumption of the prerogatives and nature of God as blasphemy apart from the use of the divine name. And so that's just a flawed answer as well. So you go through these examples, and what you find over and over and over again is that the authors are making bad arguments. They're the ones that don't know their geography. They're not carefully reading the text. They're assuming things that aren't there. They don't know their history. The issue is never, in any of these cases, that Mark is wrong. Now, again, we haven't answered the first one, so we'll come back to that in just a moment. Any questions about these alleged errors in Mark? Yes. I think you're absolutely right. People that are looking for reasons to not listen to the Bible, people that don't know the Bible and they're surfing the internet to find problems with the Bible, the unfortunate thing is that these are the kinds of things that you can find in scholarly publications. And I don't know if they're just perpetuating that kind of idea, why it is that they're not all just repeatedly taken to task. I don't know, but I think you're right that it doesn't play well with people that are really seeking deeper understanding.
So they were saying blasphemy didn't happen that day? Right?
Yeah, they were saying blasphemy didn't happen that day because...
what's the counter to that?
That when he says, I'm the Son of Man, you'll see me coming on the clouds in glory, that is the assumption of the nature of God. That they would have understood that was a claim to be God, to be divine.
And so they called that blasphemy.
Yes, they would have called that blasphemy.
So it's two things, right? They said, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed?"
Right.
Which is more than just, "Are you the Son?"
Right.
And so their question already is sort of leading down.
Yeah.
And then his answer is this quote from Daniel.
Yes, right.
It's a well-known passage that this is a divine figure, not merely...
Right. And he's equating the two, and I don't know that... I think the basic presumption is right, that the Jews of that day would not have equated the Messiah with divinity. And so Jesus' answer is twofold. I am the Christ, and I am this divine figure from Daniel 7. And that's where the charge of blindness, and that's what they react to. They don't react to just, I am the Messiah. It's, you'll see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven. And the high priest tore his garments and said, what further witness do we need? You've heard his blasphemy. What is your decision? I don't know, because Son of God would have been a messianic title, as David was the Son of God, and all of the Davidic line was the Son of God in some sense. Right, and I think they could hear him say, I'm the Christ, the Son of God, and that be less a claim to divinity in their ears than what he says after that. And so what he says makes it, you know, explicitly clear. I mean, there's no ambiguity anymore when he's quoting from Daniel 7 here.
Yeah, the problem with Son of Man and Son of God are both ambiguous statements that can have a lesser application. You know, the Jews would have called themselves sons of God, for example.
Right.
Jesus goes around calling himself the Son of Man all the time, but they don't associate that necessarily with Daniel chapter 7 and so on. So, but here,
all right, well, let's look at Matthew really quick. It's going to be shorter. Don't worry, I know at least a little bit of what I'm doing here as far as time goes. The first charge against Matthew is that Matthew follows Mark, that Matthew, and again, we're conceding this for the sake of argument, that Matthew is familiar with Mark and quoting Mark at times. We're just letting that go for this evening at least. And so the fact that Matthew follows Mark, and if Mark is error-filled, then we have a real big problem. But again, as you look at Mark and the charges that are raised against Mark, they don't hold. It actually shows that Mark does know very well the historical and cultural context. In fact, far more than the skeptics do. He was very well acquainted with what was going on geographically and politically and everything else. And so this charge goes away once you understand that there's no problem with Mark. Now, two in particular that come up very often. First, in Matthew chapter 2, what is called the slaughter of the innocents. This is the Herod the Great story. You know, this child's been born. The wise men duped me. They didn't come back. So let's kill all the babies in Bethlehem, two and under. The fact that this is not recorded anywhere else except in the Gospel of Matthew is a problem to some skeptics. I mean, Josephus doesn't mention it. Surely, if as much as Josephus talks about, including what he says about Herod the Great, if this had happened, Josephus would have mentioned it. Well, the big problem with this is that it's an argument for silence. And arguments from silence are, on some level, inherently flawed. You're making the lack of information say something. And the lack of information doesn't very often say anything. It says nothing by definition. You add to that the fact that the vast majority of the literature from the first century has been lost. And it's really hard to say nobody ever said anything about this except Matthew when like 90% or more of those documents are gone and we'll just never see them again. On top of that, practically speaking, Bethlehem was a very small town. It was a village. I mean, what we imagine, you know, when Christmas rolls around and we hear all these stories over and over again, the slaughter of the innocents, thousands and thousands of children died is kind of the idea that you get. How big do you think Bethlehem was? I mean, Bethlehem was like 500 or 600 people total. You're talking about probably a dozen children or less who died. Now, that's not to say that it's not a terrible thing of what happened to them, but this is a very small handful of children who died in this. It's not an event of civic or military importance that would have caught Josephus' interest. News traveled very slowly in the first century. It's not like Herod killed all these infants and, you know, Zechariah the high priest posted about it on Twitter and everyone found out and it was trending on Facebook before you knew it. And everyone, you know, news traveled very slowly. It would take a while for people to hear about this. And then when they did hear about it, they'd kind of shrug their shoulders and say that's Herod being Herod because he was a notoriously violent and awful and terrible king who did things like kill his sons and kill his spouses and round up Jewish leaders to have killed after he died and all sorts of other things. So Herod killing people is not newsworthy. It's normal. and you add to that everything else. I mean, if you want to press the argument from silence, then we could press it all over the place. I mean, Josephus and Philo, even though they are very interested in the dealings of the Romans and the Jews with each other, they don't mention Claudius' expulsion of the Jews from Rome. Only Suetonius mentions that, but nobody doubts that it happened. Only Suetonius mentioned it. It must have never happened because there's no other attestation than that. Therefore, it didn't. No, nobody goes to that conclusion with that. Only Pliny the Younger mentions the eruption of Mount Vesuvius. Therefore, it never happened. I mean, really? The great example of this to me is still a more modern one. Ulysses S. Grant in his autobiography, I mean, he has a very, very detailed account of the Civil War, never mentions the Emancipation Proclamation. How do you miss that one, Grant? Well, never happened. No Emancipation Proclamation because Grant doesn't mention it. I mean, really, no one's going to come to any of those kinds of conclusions based on silence in any of those places. And what I'd say is an argument from silence is almost never a good reason to disregard direct positive testimony of a contemporary author. Now, very quickly, the Demoniac is in Gadara. You remember he was in Gerasa in Mark. He's also mentioned as being in Gerasa in Luke. In Matthew, he's mentioned in Gadara. Now, let's go back to Gerasa for a second. Gerasa is a Greek word. The Aramaic, you would lose the vowels, and it would be G-R-S or K-R-S. And what you find is that there is a place called Kersa, or Gergesa, it is called in some places, that happens to be right on the Sea of Galilee, and there just so happens to be a very, very steep hill that goes right down into the water, which you can see from a variety of angles here. And so you take this, and probably what happened is some scribe very early on botched Kersa and turned it into Gerasa, as the vowels were added and it was changed into a different language. And then when you add to that the fact that this Gergesa is right here, right next to the Sea of Galilee, that probably answers the question of Mark and Luke. Now, what about Gadara? Well, Gadara is a little further away. It's right here. It's about 5.5 miles to the Sea of Galilee. Gadara was a much more significant town, and this was called the region of the Gadarenes in Matthew. And it's further inland, but it's larger. And according to Josephus, Gadara had territories and villages on the Sea of Galilee. And probably, if this was not one of their towns and villages, it could safely be called in the region of Gadara. And so Matthew is using a more regional title. Mark and Luke are using the more village-specific title, which has unfortunately been associated with Gerasa way down here. And that's, I think, the best solution to what's going on here. But, I mean, if you want to talk region versus city, you know, where do the Bucks play football? Do they play football in Tampa or do they play football in Florida? Well, one of those statements is wrong because it's not the exact same word, right? Well, no. And you understand what's going on there. So is it Gergesa, is it Kersa, or is it the region of Gadara? Would you say the Bucks don't play football anyway? Yeah, we've watched them this year too. So you look at all of this, and what it all boils down to. Oh, and here we go. So another kind of map. Gadara's over here in the distance. Gergesa is right here, not that far from each other anyway. So you look at all of this together, and what you have is skeptics that don't know their geography. They don't know their history. They have very bad reading skills in a lot of places, and they seriously misinterpret the text. And the charges against Mark and Matthew, you just fall apart over and over again. All right, next week we'll come back and talk about the alleged historical errors in the other Gospels. Thank you for your attention and patience, kids.